Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host today, Monica Hadley, and our guest is Jean Carstensen. Jean is an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, Foreign Policy, and Salon, and broadcast nationally on the world. She covered the Syrian refugee crisis in Greece and Turkey and has been awarded grants and fellowships from the Pulitzer Center, Logan Nonfiction Program, and Mesa Refuge, where she was the Peter Barnes Long-Form Journalism Fellow. Jean lives in San Francisco, and the book that we are talking about today is A Greek Tragedy, One Day, A Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Jean.
Thank you so much.
Now, I think a lot of us probably do remember this event happening. I definitely remember it because I have been to Lesbos. Is that how you pronounce it?
Lesbos? Yes, you can pronounce it either way. Pronounce it Lesbos.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was there in May of 2019, and I've been to all the places that you write about in the book. I met a few of the people that you write about in the book. I even was in the refugee camp. And so so this is something that is fascinates me, because I never knew the whole story. I just, knew that this horrible tragedy had happened, but you really delve into the human story and also how it happened and why it happened. So, Jean, what drew you to this part of the world that you were there when this happened?
Well, I was working as a freelance foreign correspondent at the time. I had already visited Lesbos as a tourist and had fallen in love with that island and that part of the world. And so then in 2015, when we started seeing the news that there was a mass movement of Syrians and other people from Turkey across to Lesbos, I was very interested in covering it as a journalist. So I'd been there as a tourist, but I returned as a journalist, and I was reporting for the radio program The World and Foreign Policy and other places. And I just wanted to cover this amazing, amazing mass movement of people. And so I had been on the island for about 6 weeks when October 28th, 2015, when that terrible shipwreck happened. So I was there reporting on it. And it was years later, like in about 2019, when I couldn't get that shipwreck out of my mind. I felt I was so close, but yet I really didn't know any of the human stories behind it. So then I decided to go back and write a book about it.
And it wasn't that easy to track people down at that point, was it?
No, it really wasn't. And it was kind of an act of faith. At first, I didn't know whether I'd be able to find people, because just to remind your listeners, at that time, something like 6,000 or 7,000 or 8,000 people were landing on the island of Lesbos every single day. And in the month of October alone, 130,000, which is almost double the population of the island. And so the numbers are very numbing, even for a journalist. It's just, how can you make sense of it? And that's another reason I wanted to get very specific and go really deep into one incident. And so those boats were run by smugglers, and there's no passenger lists. And so the shipwreck I write about, it was not a rubber boat. It was this double-decker wooden boat that was in terrible shape, and they overloaded it.
And that the passengers, many of them had paid top dollar to be on this boat because they thought it was like a cruise boat almost.
Yes. I mean, this is what the smugglers do, because the European Union and would not grant travel visas. Most of the people at that time were very middle class or upper middle class people. These were all people with jobs in Syria or jobs in Afghanistan. I met people from, everything, doctors, journalists, artists, farmers, policemen, any profession that you could imagine. So they had means. These were not poor people, but they would have preferred to just pay for plane tickets and fly to Germany and then ask for asylum. But that option was not open to them, so they have to turn to smugglers. And what happens is the smugglers, it's a big criminal network, but they're also providing a service. And so both parties need each other. And what happens is that the lower level smugglers who are trying to attract clients who are the refugees, they kind of will say whatever, they spin a story about what a great trip it's going to be. So if they say, oh, you'll be going on a rubber raft, they'll say, don't worry, you'll be completely safe. There's only going to be like 10 or 15 people in the raft. My family crossed in the same way, everything's fine. They make promises like this, and then the refugees, these people are very intelligent people, and they know inside that they're still taking a huge risk, but then they're hopeful that maybe the smugglers are telling the truth. And with this incident in my book, oh gosh, I mean, one man on the boat, Okba, he was from Syria, and he was huge, 470 pounds. And he got himself to Istanbul and he was staying with a Syrian family, friends of his family. And they said, hey, we know a good smuggler who has helped other people, other friends of ours. So Okba meets the smuggler and the smuggler pulls out a photograph of a yacht, of a white brand new yacht with little cabins and portals, windows, and said, you'll get this. This isn't the exact ship that you'll be on, but it's very, very similar. And Okba paid $2,500 to get a ticket or, to get the right to go on this boat. And this is for a 45-minute crossing that a ferry costs 14 euros.
And I've done that crossing. I went from Lesbos over to
Assos. No, to
Ayvalık, to Ayvalık,
Ayvalık.
to go to the Turkish bazaar and see some of the mosques and so forth. Yeah, it's normally pretty easy.
Yes, and I had done it. I'd gone back and forth on a ferry. So imagine how stark it is when you're on that coast. And I'm a journalist or I'm a tourist. I happen to be from the US and I pay my 14 euros and I arrive, and on the very same day, people who are families and professions of all kinds coming from Afghanistan and Syria, they're risking their lives and they have to turn to smugglers, and the boats are all overcrowded, and many of them are in terrible, terrible condition. Sometimes it's a smooth crossing, but that area of the world, it's right near ancient Troy. And Homer writes all the time of the winds in that region. And they're known, these northwesterly winds that come blasting down. So even though it's only 5 miles across, it can turn very deadly. And that's how it was on October 28th, gale force winds.
And I, one of the things that just bothered me the most, I think, was that these refugees were being sold at very high prices, life jackets that weren't life jackets. They were fake.
Yes, this was widely documented at the time by journalists from all different publications, but often the news did not reach refugees. So whether they were in Istanbul or they were in Izmir and they're getting ready for the trip, their smugglers would send them to these shops. And I've seen these with my own eyes where they were piled high with life jackets that looked real. They were bright orange. They had logos on them. They had buckles. But they were being manufactured very cheaply with fake foam in it that was not really flotation foam. And so they would be charged a regular price and they would think they were keeping their families safe. And In fact, these were crappy life jackets.
I just can't understand how anybody could do that.
It is hard to understand. I mean, that's just greedy people looking for a fast dollar. It is really hard to understand.
So, the reasons that these people are taking this risk in many cases are matters of life and death. You know, that they're fleeing real threats to their lives.
Yes, definitely. In 2015, the Syrian civil war had been going for 4 years, and already some 6 million Syrians had fled the country because the whole thing was a war zone. There were, ISIS had come in. There were all these different factions. It was incredibly violent, and everybody has their own story, but many people literally could not stay in their towns. It was not safe. Sometimes they try and go to another area in the country where it's less dangerous, and then finally they can't stay there. So the neighboring countries of Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon were filled with Syrian refugees who were hoping to be able to return to Syria, and they couldn't. And so in 2015, a lot of them decided to try their luck in Europe. They thought they could get a better start there. And this population, a lot of them were families or young people who wanted to get educated and start families. And they saw Germany or other European countries as the best place to do it. And maybe 50% of the people on the boat that I wrote about were Syrian. About 25% were Afghans. And Afghanistan has just had decades of war after war, instability after instability. Sometimes one war ends, you think it's going to be a stable period, but it would explode again. And they also had tremendous corruption. Warlords ran the country. And this is what happened to one of my main characters, a young man named Hidayat, who worked in a bank, very successful and young. He was only 24, but he already had two sons, and his wife was pregnant. And he got caught up when the warlords started pressuring him at the bank to give them money. And he was in a horrible position if he did it. And this was common, very, very common that this would happen. But as the loan officer, he felt that he would be blamed. And then when he resisted, these gangs started targeting his family. So they could not stay and had to leave. And, every story is different, but there's often a reason like that behind originally why people feel that they just couldn't stay safe in their own countries because nobody wants to leave.
So let's talk about the four people that you focus on in the book. You've already mentioned Okba, who was the very large Syrian man. And
Yes.
at the end of the book, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say that all of the people that you write about, because you were in, had to talk to them, that they all survived, but not necessarily all their family members, but that
Right,
those
that's what we don't
individuals
know.
survived. Yeah,
Yes,
and
yes.
so. Well, I have a question. At the end of the book, he's talking about hoping to go back to Syria someday if Assad's regime falls, which it finally has after this book probably was finished and completed. Do you know if he's going to be able to go to return?
Well, I've texted with him a little bit. Okba speaks Arabic, and I do not speak Arabic. So he and I have a Syrian friend of his who I met who does speak English. We communicate through him. And, Okba still dreams of going back, but it's not so simple because he's waiting to see, like many Syrians in the diaspora are waiting to see what happens in Syria. Is it going to stabilize? Is it going to be, you know, a more secular, inclusive government, or are we going to see a sort of new kind of dictatorship form? So he's a little bit wait and see, but hopeful that he will at least be able to go back to visit and then maybe move back someday.
Wow. What proportion of the Syrian population has left Syria, left Syria during this time? Do we know?
I don't remember what, you know, percentage. I'm pretty sure that it's something like 13 million Syrians have been displaced. And some of those, maybe half, were internally displaced. You know, imagine if you're from Portland, Oregon, and you have to run to, I don't know, San Francisco or Seattle to stay safe. And you're maybe staying on somebody's couch, or you've got some temporary arrangement. So people have moved around within Syria, and then at least 6 million are outside of the country. Most of them are still in neighboring countries, and then numbers are in Europe and the U.S. and other places where they've managed to get to safety.
Wow. Okay, so we have Okba, and then you also spoke about the one that starts with an H.
Hidayat.
And then who are the, and he was from Afghanistan. And then who are the other two kind
the
of
other
characters
are,
in the book?
Yes. It's strange to say character because this is nonfiction.
Yeah.
But it's just a way of referring to them, people in the book. And you really get to know these four people really deeply. And some people have said, you know, that my book is nonfiction with a novelistic feel to it because of how deeply you get to know the characters. So Rizwana, also from Afghanistan, she was 13 at the time, and an amazing, amazing girl, the eldest of four. And her parents, her father was a journalist and a videographer for One TV in Kabul. And One TV has since been shut down, but at the time when independent media was thriving for a while in Afghanistan, it was a very powerful independent station. But what happened there is the Taliban was starting to come back, and they specifically targeted One TV. And so her father was at tremendous risk, and he felt that he had to get the family away. But here's a story I always like to tell about Rizwana. Is her father would get her work doing voiceover for Turkish and American movies that needed to be dubbed into Farsi for the Afghan audience. And so she had a little bit of work doing this voiceover for the children's parts. And I just loved thinking of her there inside whatever kind of studio it was. And she was very full of life, only 13, but already had a sense of a big future ahead of her. And she didn't want to leave. She was told they were going to Sweden, where they had relatives. And she said to her dad, "I don't want to go to Sweden. It's too cold. It's dark all the time. Can we go somewhere else?" But they left, and she traveled with her whole family. And then the one other person is Amel. Amel was 27 at the time. She's a Syrian woman who had studied a little bit of journalism, didn't like journalism, and was wanting to be an artist. And she was part of the Syrian diaspora in Istanbul. It was not safe for her to be in Syria anymore because she had participated in resistance, you know, protests and things like this. And so she was in Istanbul, and then her fiance was already in Germany, and she wanted to join him, and she couldn't get a visa. She tried three times, and it was rejected. So finally, she decided to go in the boat and she met a smuggler in Istanbul. She asked her friends, "Hey, do you guys know any good smugglers? Do you know people you can trust?" And that's what people would do. And you tried to find the best person or situation you could. And the thing that one of the many amazing things about Amel is the day of the shipwreck, which she didn't know that it was going to be a shipwreck, but she was wearing a waterproof camera on her wrist and ended up filming the entire incident.
Wow. And she has used that to make a documentary, correct?
Yes, you'll find this out in the epilogue. Yes, that after she makes it through, which it was very scary for her. In many moments, she thought that she would drown. She was wearing one of these life jackets that wasn't so good, and like many Syrians, she grew up in the mountains in Syria and didn't really know how to swim, just a little bit, was not comfortable in the water. It was very frightening for her. But yes, afterwards, she made her own personal, beautiful film about this experience, and it screened at the Berlin Biennale and other places.
Wow. Is there any place, anywhere you can see it online? Do you know?
She does not have the whole movie online. I think you could maybe rent it, but you can certainly see the trailer and get a sense of her experience, the footage, her style. She's just amazing. And she's now in Leipzig and she has a daughter now. But when you're reading the book, you don't know any of this, right?
No,
So we're kind of in a way jumping ahead. You don't
yes.
learn this till the end. Yeah.
How did you select these four people as the main characters in the book?
Well, people ask me that. It was somewhat organic. I mean, when you asked me before how I found them, I didn't really finish that because I started talking about them and it was hard to find them. And they could have been anywhere at the time because I started looking for them 4 years later. So when I went back to Lesvos in 2019 and I talked to a lot of local people and fishermen and activists who were there on October 28th, and they all remembered that day. And I asked them, "Were you in touch with any people from that day?" And the one person everybody remembered was this large guy. This really, they would say, he was so immense, this huge fat man. We couldn't get him off the boat, after he was rescued. And finally, I got a photo of this guy, and a photojournalist friend of mine had written down his name. And I wrote a small article and had it translated into Arabic and had a Syrian friend put it up on Arabic language Facebook all over Europe. And with his picture, and I said, "I'm a journalist. I'm hoping to speak to this man." And we eventually found him
Oh, wow.
that way. And then it was very important to me that people wanted to participate in this project. I didn't want them to feel pressured in any way because I'm asking them to speak about a very traumatic event. And so a Syrian friend of mine approached Okba and asked, told him about me and my book. And it turned out he really did want to speak to me. And so that's how I found him. I found Hidayat, the Afghan young man who worked in the bank, because a nurse on Lesvos, who I'd interviewed many times, she had stayed in touch with him. She helped him after the shipwreck and had his phone number, and she had followed his life after the shipwreck a little bit. And she eventually was willing to share his contact info with me. And again, I had an Afghan person approach him and ask, does he want to tell his story? And he did. So those were the first two, and I had to go to where they were because you can't do this kind of thing remotely. So I went to Germany. That's where Okba, the large Syrian guy, he had ended up getting asylum in Germany, and I flew there. And then I also flew to Ankara, Turkey, where Hidayat had ended up eventually. And I chose them because they were willing to talk to me, because their stories were so interesting. So it just became an organic thing. And then I found later Amel and Rizwana. I found them through other journalists who had written about them, but they hadn't been able to go in depth about what had happened to them. And it just sort of came together organically. It's not like I had, 25 people to choose from and then narrowed it down to four. It sort of happened organically. At
Right.
first, I was only going to write about Hedayat and Okba, but then decided it would be really wonderful to include a young Afghan girl and this young Syrian artist and have two men and two women. And I was worried as a writer about how do I have four distinct refugees in a boat and tell their story. But it turned out it really was the right choice to have those four people.
Well, why don't you
And
share a little bit of their voices from your book?
okay, that's a great idea. This is from chapter 17, and it's when they've already gotten to the coast and they've gotten on the boat and the boat is headed out and it's smooth when they first leave. And you'll hear a little bit from each of the four refugees that we've been talking about.
And this is Jean Carstensen reading from her book, A Greek Tragedy.
From the upper deck, everything seemed fine at first. Amel sat on the right, holding on to the metal railing. Malik was next to her, texting their location to the WhatsApp group. The sea was smooth as the boat left the port. It was so sunny, Malik didn't even bother to put on his coat. They noticed that two other boats left the port the same time they did and were motoring alongside. Were they smugglers? The Turkish Coast Guard? They'd heard stories about the Coast Guard knifing rubber boats or setting them adrift. It made them nervous, but they tried to put their fears out of their mind. Malik texted their friends. We're fine. Down below on the main deck were Hedayat and Zora. Zora is his wife, huddled with the boys in the back corner. Waves thudded against the side of the hull. Hedayat craned his neck over the side. He saw a green mountain in the distance, the Greek island where they were headed, he assumed. It didn't look too far. The afternoon sun was blinding, but the wind felt cool on his sweat-soaked back and neck. He and Zora zipped up the boys' puffy coats tightly around their necks, under their two big life jackets, and cradled them close to their bodies. Crouched inside the galley under the spiral staircase with her family, Rizwana counted the minutes until they would reach the other side. The smugglers had told them half an hour to reach Lesvos. She didn't have her watch, but she marked the time by her pounding heart. She calculated they'd been sailing for 10 minutes. Everything seemed to be going well. Her parents and three younger brothers and sisters were all together inside this little white room, and soon they would be in Greece. Then water began lapping over the side, filling the galley with several inches. Rizwana's mother was standing by the entrance and had a better view than Rizwana and could see the entire boat was taking on water. Nasir, we should go upstairs, she said to her husband. Okba heard cracking noises coming from the center of the boat. Up above, dozens of people dangled from the stairs and clung to the metal railing. As the boat pitched sharply from side to side in the waves, the entire upper story began to rock. Unable to move because of his sprained ankle, he watched as several men jumped up and leaned their backs and shoulders into the posts to try and keep them from buckling. The structure groaned and splintered as the boat leaned precariously to the right.
That was Jean Carstensen reading from A Greek Tragedy. Now let's turn our attention a little bit to the other characters in the book who are the people who were helping the refugees in one way or another. And you address the issue, and I, you know, I know from my visit there that this was true, that it was so overwhelming for the inhabitants of the island that some of them were very resentful. And like when I went in 2019, part of the reason that I went there was one of my friends and neighbors here, Stacy Katoxis, who is a Greek heritage and had spent a lot of time in Greece and a lot of time on Lesbos, was trying to get people to come over there. We were practicing group meditation. She wanted to get a group doing group transcendental meditation to kind of, you know, maybe put some coherence in the environment, but also to help. She had a project in the camps doing art. She's an artist, and so she would bring art supplies, and we went in and did a jewelry making. You know, we brought all these beads that someone had donated, and the women and the young people were just so excited to have something to do that was fun and creative, you know. So, but tourism was still devastated because people were avoiding the island that used to go there as tourists because of this. And so there was a lot of people who resented the refugees, but then there were people who gave everything to help. And do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, by 2019, it was really very different. More of this anti-migrant sentiment had come up because after what they'd been through for years of people coming and not getting much support, it became fertile ground for very anti-migrant views to take over. In 2015, it was a mix. I mean, there were thousands of people traipsing through their villages every single day, and it was overwhelming. But there was, for a lot of people, a spirit of decency, trying to help where they could. And in the book, I focus on some amazing people. There's Melinda McCrosty, who's a restaurant owner in Molivos. And Molivos was this beautiful town, about 2,000 people, with an ancient castle up above, and it's a very popular place for people to visit. It's also a fishing village, and so during the rescue, that's where the Coast Guard and the fishing boats were delivering the people. And Melinda was kind of at ground zero for almost a year, and she was one of the first locals to start making sandwiches and giving people water. And her efforts grew from just helping a few hundred people to helping thousands. And she ended up creating a nonprofit organization called Starfish. And it's just incredible what she did. But she was also found herself in between these huge historical events that she couldn't control, of all these people coming, and then her community, where some of the restaurant owners and hotel owners were very resentful, as you say. So she was always trying to help people, but also was mindful of what could she do to keep them out of the central areas and anything she could do to avoid conflict. Mm. So it was very interesting to see her struggle. And in the end, her efforts were not appreciated, and she and her husband decided to leave Molivos because, even though she had raised her kids there, Melinda's originally from Australia, but grew up on the island of Lesbos from age 7. So she's functionally a local, and she's married to a Greek man. And yeah, they were driven out eventually. But oh, wow. That day, and in my book, you just see how much she did to try and help. There was not really a top-down, centralized plan for how to respond to the shipwreck or any shipwreck. So everything was very chaotic. And yes, there were a lot of volunteers there that had come from all over the world, and there were some big aid agencies, but nobody was coordinating this. So everybody just arrived to the village, and sees the people coming in, the victims, they're cold and scared, and then you see dead bodies, and then you see children with terrible hypothermia who are on the edge of death. And, Melinda that night was yelling and trying to make sure that a volunteer, any child who didn't have somebody taking care of him or her, somebody would grab that child. It was a very spontaneous effort to try and care for everybody as best they could. There are only three ambulances on the whole island, and it was about an hour to an hour and a half for an ambulance to arrive from the main hospital to this town. And these were, the ambulances were broken down. And so meanwhile, these medics, volunteer medics and local people were trying to keep these hypothermic children alive. And I write about this a lot in my book. And I was very moved by people's efforts and by Melinda's efforts to do whatever she could that night and for many weeks during that time.
And some of the other people who were so involved were fishermen, other restaurant owners in Scala,
Scala Sica Menius.
Yes, which I went there. I ate at that restaurant. I bought jewelry.
Tokima.
I bought some jewelry in the in some shops there. And I spoke with probably the same guy that you write about.
The owner of Tokima.
Yeah.
His name is Otis.
Yeah, and that was one of the. Well, tell us about that village and what they had to face during this entire time.
Yes, so the north of Lesvos, it's a beautiful coastline, quite remote, and it faces out across to Turkey. And so this stretch of coastline received most of the people. And the little village of Scala Sica Menius only has about 150 residents. And one thing that's interesting is in 1922, when Greek refugees had to flee Asia Minor and they came across in terrible boats, much, much like people came across today, that village of Scala Sica Menius, many of its residents are actually descendants of these 1922 refugees. And so there's a lot of memory there. And I think there was maybe some extra empathy. And a lot of people in that tiny, tiny village, they created a storeroom. This is before any journalists were there. Like in June, when people started coming, the world didn't know what was going on, but they had hundreds of people arriving and they were asking for clothing donations from around the island and they didn't have anybody to help. And so the fishermen would often have to go out because they would hear something out on the water at night, or they would see one of these rubber rafts that it was sinking because these were horrible cheap rafts and they were overfilled. And some of the fishermen in the village rescued, we'll never know how many, but it could be as many as thousands of people.
Wow.
There were only two Coast Guard patrol boats available. And they did help some people, but they depended on the fishermen to do things that they couldn't do. So the civilian population got really involved. And on the day of the shipwreck, it was two Coast Guard, Greek Coast Guard, and one Frontex boat. Frontex is the European Border Patrol Agency, and nine fishing boats at least, and most were from Greece, but two fishing boats came from Turkey to help.
Now, what was the town in Turkey where this boat set off from?
It's called Sivrice. I had never heard about it before, but it's one of the little villages just directly across from Lesvos. And in 2015, I had been over on that coastline reporting about the smuggling operations there, and I had seen boats leaving from that side. But when I decided to write this book, I really wanted to know exactly where did this boat leave from? And eventually I found from Amel, the Syrian woman who was wearing the wrist camera, she shared the GPS data with me, and it showed that the boat left from Sivriche. So I went back there in 2021 and worked with a Turkish journalist, and we were able to find fishermen that saw the boat leave that day. They showed me exactly where it left from. They told me what kind of boat it was, and they had watched it leave overloaded with people. They had begged the smugglers, don't send it, don't send it. This is too dangerous. And then they'd watched with binoculars as it went out towards the center of the channel, and the waves got bigger and bigger, and they actually saw it sink. And then they decided, at great risk to themselves, they decided to go out and help in the rescue.
And they were facing not just the risk of being in the storm-tossed waters, but also the risk of being arrested for crossing an international border, which is just mind-boggling to me.
Yes, and I think the biggest risk was, at that time, almost any person, Turkish person out on the waters, it would be very easy for them to just be accused of being smugglers, whether they were or not. And I think that was their biggest fear. Even though they were out there helping, the Greek Coast Guard might have just not believed them and said, you know, you're smugglers and we're going to drag you into jail, and their boats could have been confiscated. So these Turkish fishermen really took even more risk to do what they did than the Greek side.
And there wasn't very much cooperation between Greece and Turkey at that point, was there?
No, really none at all. You have really none at all. It was more antagonistic. So everybody would look the other way. I mean, if a boat sank in the Turkish waters, then the Turkish Coast Guard would be responsible for it. But if they could, they might let it drift over into Greek waters so that the Greeks would have to deal with it, and vice versa. But it was sort of like a big race or a big game of Survivor or something, because the goal was to get across the international sea border into Greek waters, because once they were in Greek waters and they were inside the European Union and therefore had the right to seek asylum, and they would be, you know, inside Europe and one step closer to getting to Germany or another country where they hoped they would be accepted as asylum seekers.
What an odd system.
It's not really a system, right? It's not a system.
No. So what it has improved, though. It did improve. There was a treaty at some point between Greece and Turkey after this event.
Yes, but it wasn't, that was really not an improvement. It was the beginning of the new era that we're in, where Europe and the United States will pay other countries to keep refugees back. So the EU-Turkey deal in the March of 2016, the European Union paid Erdogan's government billions of dollars, and the agreement was that they would stop the traffic coming across to Greece. And in exchange, this money was supposed to be used to support Turkey's efforts to care for the refugees in Turkey. But there's no accountability around that. And now there's a lot of deals like this. The European Union has made deals like this with Libya. And that's even more cynical, because it's absolutely proven that Libya is a failed state and it is not respecting the human rights of all the refugees inside its borders. And in fact, people are put in very, very dangerous locked camps. And it's a terrible thing. And now we're doing this in the U.S. with some of our deals with Mexico and, you know, other countries, instead of taking the obligation that we have of at least giving them the right to apply for asylum, we're paying other countries to try and keep them out.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Jean Carstensen, author of A Greek Tragedy, One Day, A Deadly Shipwreck, and the Human Cost of the Refugee Crisis. So you mentioned that there were a lot of volunteers there. Some of them probably were more valuable than others in terms of providing services. And one of the ones that a group that you write about quite a bit in the book and that were so crucial to the rescue efforts were the lifeguards. So would you like to tell us a little bit about them and then maybe read something
Yes.
about what they were doing?
Yes. The Spanish lifeguards, they were based in Barcelona, and it was a very large lifeguard company there, and they were contracted out all summer for keeping beaches safe and for all different kinds of water sports and all of that. So they were not a humanitarian group, but Oscar Camps, who was the CEO of this company, he started following what was happening up in Greece and seeing images of dead kids and all of that. And he was just horrified because as a lifeguard, it's like, what? People are dying in European waters. Why is this happening? And so he and Gerard, another lifeguard from Spain, they went to Lesbos just to check it out and see could their services be useful. Well, they didn't even leave for 2 years. I mean, it was immediately obvious that their services were needed. And by October 28th, there were about 8 lifeguards on the island, and they had brought 2 jet skis from Spain. So they had some tools to help. And that day, the jet skis had just arrived the day before. And normally you would not take jet skis out for a rescue into gale force winds, but that's all they had. And it was a May Day call around the island. And so, you know, they looked on the cliffs with their binoculars. They could see all these people in the water. And with the fishermen and other people, they just didn't think about it and rushed out. And I wanted to read a little bit about when they arrive to the scene and they start rescuing. And Oscar described it. He was just in complete shock. It looked like there had been a plane crash. So there's 2 men on each jet ski, and they're in the midst of hundreds of people who need help. And the official boats, the patrol boats and the Frontex boats, they can't get to the people because they're very high boats. They're not really made for rescue. So it really fell on these guys they were on the front lines of getting people out of the water. Acting on instinct, Gerard and Oscar grabbed the children and the babies first. Face down, let them go. But if there was any sign of life, scoop the child up. Parents with babies and toddlers slumped on their shoulders or floating on a plank, waved and yelled for the lifeguards to take their child. Those looks, Oscar recalled, about the pleading mothers. With lips and jaws numb from the cold, they couldn't utter a sound. They didn't speak the same language anyway, but their eyes drilled into him. I am begging you, take my child, they seemed to say. If the child's eyes were open and glassy, staring into nothingness like a ghost, he couldn't bear to say what he knew to be true. Senora, your child is dead. It's too late, man, Gerard said to himself as he passed the body of a little girl bobbing up and down in the waves on the right side of his jet ski. She floated face down. Gerard knew he should move on, that he was breaking his own rule. But the girl in a white and pink candy-striped hoodie, with 2 pigtails sprouting from the top of her head, severed the pathway to the part of his brain that should have made the risk-benefit calculation that it was best to leave the child behind so he could help others with a higher chance of survival. In spite of himself, he reached out an arm like a crane, grabbed the girl by the collar with his gloved hand, and plucked the precious 20-pound human out of the water. He laid her down tenderly so she rested on his lap with her head on the jet ski console in front of him. Maybe 2 years old, dark eyes, just like my daughter. Weak little fish breaths sputtered out from between her icy blue lips, often the last gasps, devoid of oxygen, before drowning is complete. "What are you doing?" Gerard said to himself, scrunching up the sides of his face to hold back the tears. He pinched her tiny nostrils closed, tilted her head back, and clamped his mouth over hers. "One, two." He poured air from his windpipe into her limp but occasionally spasming body. "One, two." You're losing time here, Gerard," he told himself, trying to calm the emotions this baby girl had unleashed in him. In a more orderly rescue situation, he might have been able to bring her back, but not here on the jet ski, alone, getting tossed about without a bag mask ventilator, without oxygen. His best shot was rushing her over to the patrol boat where Danny and Nico could attend to her. In a blur of red and yellow, the bold colors of the open arms lifeguards' uniforms, Nico clambered down the ladder from the deck of the patrol boat onto the platform, leapt into the roiling sea, swam over to the jet ski, and crawled up onto the sled. He took the little girl from Gerard and, holding her in the crook of his right arm, with her limp legs dangling at his side, he splashed back to the boat, trying to keep her head out of the water. Danny sprawled out on his stomach like a red and yellow beetle with orange neoprene legs, waited on the platform as Nico approached. Danny grabbed onto the forearm of the Coast Guard standing next to him with one hand, then stretched his other arm out as far as he could to receive the girl. Water streamed through her pigtails, washing under her lemon-yellow inflatable life jacket as if she were under the shower. Meanwhile, Nico hauled himself onto the platform, spun around, and handed the girl to the Coast Guard, who passed her up to Danny, who had flown up the ladder to the deck. The lifeguard pressed his adult fingers into the girl's sternum. "Uno, dos, tres, uno, dos, tres. No nos vaya, nena. Don't die on us, little girl."
Jean Carstensen reading from her book, A Greek Tragedy. Now, Jean, this is your first published book, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And how long working on this?
Well, it's been a decade since the shipwreck. And so in a way, you could say a decade. I was a reporter on this migration crisis for about 3 years. And then I started the process maybe in 2018 of thinking about the book and writing the proposal. So it's been a good 6 years, I would say, of being immersed in this project. I had to travel a lot, and I had to even travel during COVID and, you know, 6 international reporting trips in order to do the interviews necessary for the book.
So were you still working on other short projects, or were you focused completely on this?
I was focused completely on this. It was the kind of book, it just took my full attention. And wow. Yes, I was not.
That's a huge investment for you to make.
Yes, it was. It was a huge investment, but I felt I had to put my all into it to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish. Half measures were not going to work. I really needed to give it my full focus. And, you know, there were some crazy things I did. Like in the final part of the book, Hadayat, the Afghan man, he with his 2 young sons and his wife, Sora. So you see in the book that after the shipwreck, he's still looking for his wife, Sora, and his youngest son. He's not sure whether they're dead or alive, and he's, of course, hoping that they're alive. He's very, very traumatized. And what happens is a cousin of Zora, his wife, comes from Belgium to help him. And so just one example of the reporting involved in the book, I went to Belgium and then to a small coastal town called Blankenberg, simply to meet this young man, Anwar, the cousin of Zora. And I asked myself at the time, what am I doing? I'm going to this country just to speak to one person. But it was really, really worth it, because Anwar spent 3 weeks with Hidayat after the shipwreck, helping him try and search here and there and everywhere. And he gave me a perspective I never could have had otherwise, had I not met him and spoken to him directly.
And part of the reason that it was so challenging to find your family members is that there was always the possibility that some of them ended up back in Turkey.
Yes.
Yeah. And like you said, there was very little coordination of where people were being sent and where they were, and it was chaotic.
It was so chaotic. And it's not like, imagine if how terrible it is if there's a commercial plane accident, or if there's a commercial cruise accident of some sort. But when that happens, there's a coordinated rescue, and you know the names of all the people on board, and there is a very focused effort to find every single person dead or alive. But with these refugee shipwrecks, it's much more chaotic. You don't know who was on the boat in the first place. You don't know their names. You don't know how many people. You don't know what countries they're from. And so in this incident, there were about 350 people in the water. We'll never know the exact number. And then after the shipwreck, bodies are washing up for days. This is a very hard thing to say, but bodies were washing up for days. And sometimes bodies, the currents will carry them over to Turkey, or maybe, a Turkish fisherman could have rescued somebody and taken them back to Turkey. And this keeps the cycle of hope alive for people like Hidayat. It was very hard for him to accept that maybe his wife and youngest son had died, because who knows, maybe they hadn't. Maybe they were picked up and they were somewhere else. And so this is a problem that many migrants face all over the world. You know, one of these stunning statistics is that since 2014 in the Mediterranean, over 31,000 people have drowned, are dead or gone missing. And this is considered a drastic undercount. So imagine the families of these people. These people could be from anywhere, really anywhere in the world. But what happens is the families don't know. Years go by. You assume your family member is dead if you can't find them. But many times people don't know what boat were they on, where they might have disappeared. And it's so important for humans to be able to pay their last respects to their loved ones. And this is another aspect in my book. I was so inspired by people on Lesbos. One woman, particularly Effie Latsudi, who really led the effort to, as best as possible, make sure that any migrants or refugees who died trying to reach her island, she wanted them to be respectfully buried. And, after this shipwreck, and we haven't mentioned, but in the end, it turned out that at least 76 people drowned that night. And then there's an unknown number of missing. So it's never a final number. But this overwhelmed the morgue. There was no room.
Overwhelmed the cemetery.
And overwhelmed the cemetery. And they had to, in a very random way, open up a migrant cemetery. And
Well, Jean, we could talk a lot more about that, but we're out of time. And I want to thank you for being with us today. I'm going to close with a quote from the poem Home by British Somali poet Warren Shire that you've probably heard this line before. You have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land.
That is absolutely true.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.